Neck throughs, guitars, they're like a guy that you won't have a beer with you.
I want to hear what's pushing the notes.
Freddie King and B.B. King, Albert King, and let's not forget Burger King.
I don't want to blow my knuckle out.
Stainless steel is the work of the devil.
These go to 11.
From the East Amplification Tone Labs in Baltimore, Maryland, it's the Amps and Axes Show. With your hosts, Jeff the Godfather of Low Wattage Amps Bober and Mick Marcellino.
Well, good day to you, Mr. Bober.
Good day to you, Mr. Marcellino.
You gotta stop that.
I tried. You won't let me.
That was good.
Yeah.
That got me. That one took me off guard there.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, you guys will never hear that.
That's right.
So once again, thank you to our fans.
Thank you, fans.
Guys. You guys are blowing us up. It's awesome. You're spreading the word. Mm-hmm. Look, we don't have any advertising. We don't have a billboard on the street. We don't go in the magazines. We can't afford crap. We can barely afford this. So thank you so much for spreading the word.
We don't have a billboard?
No. Those things are like $15,000 a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And, you know, only so many people were going to see it. It didn't like you have billboards around the country. You just won.
I think I'm going to get a white bed sheet and a can of paint.
There you go.
Fix this.
Put it right out in the front lawn.
That's it.
There you go. So thank you, guys. We're a little delusional here today.
It's a little crazy.
Thanks for going through and clicking on all the banners, which you can find at Amps and Axes Cast. .com. Don't forget, visit the page. Definitely go out to the iTunes. Give us some likes. Give us some reviews. Tell us what we're doing right, wrong.
Give us the five likes.
Yeah, we like the five stars.
That's right.
The five stars are awesome. And don't forget our good buddy who works harder than anybody, Jason Sidetis.
Yes.
And he's got the new ones are just mind boggling. So you're going to have some time.
You're going to need some time.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where he pulls it from.
It's what they call a real musician.
Yeah, it's scary what he comes up with.
Yeah.
Not just once, but now like 22 times.
But who's counting?
It's me.
But who's counting?
I am a little bit, but, you know, it's amazing. And he pulls it off. He does the tab. We can't ask enough. This is free lessons, people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can't thank the guy enough, man. Definitely check out his page. Check out his YouTube page. That's where you can find all that stuff.
And his music.
Yes.
Please.
And it's on our page, but I use his YouTube so that way he gets the hits because he's doing it for us.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. And, you know he has some stellar players with him on this stuff. So check it out. Everyone would appreciate it, including him and even the stellar players he has, because
every little bit counts,
everybody
man.
Likes to listen.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, real quick, before you get into your thing there, I just wanted to mention, there's another podcast, a couple guys that are, that do what we do, but they do it a little bit different. They do more review stuff, but we want to give a shout out to them. It's 60 Cycle Hum Podcast. Pretty cool guys. I've listened to a couple of their shows, and maybe we can do a little cross-pollinate, have them on, we'll be on, you know, do that thing, kind of. Spread the audience, they get into
reciprocal.
Yeah. They a good bunch of guys. They start following us and start following them. You know, right? And they, it's all good.
There you go.
So I just wanted to give a shout out to those guys and maybe we can get them on the air one day.
Yeah. They're
sit down, talk.
Yeah. Definitely do a different thing. But
yeah.
And that's very cool because it's all about diversity.
Yeah. The podcast world, it's not like the radio world where everybody's competing against each other. It's kind of like it's a big internet. So you can just cut, just cut a slice of your pie and just go. You don't have to have some of their slice. It's everybody. Look, it's on demand whenever you want to listen to it. It's when you listen to it.
That's true. That's the cool thing about it.
Yeah.
That's
so cool. It isn't like, hey, we're on from 6 to 10. You just download it and listen to it when you can, and that's all good.
Totally. You know?
So, yeah.
Well, and there you go. 60 Cycle Hum.
Absolutely.
Give them a listen.
Yeah, so, do it.
And let us know what you think.
Yeah.
Or let them know what you think about us. However you want to do that.
However you want to do it.
Do it both ways.
Yes.
You know, we don't care. Hey, just real quick. I I was thumbing through one of the magazines the other day, and I found a very cool article. Joel Danzig, who also writes for Premier Guitar, the founder of Hamer.
Oh, okay.
He just wrote a little thing called The Musician's Clubhouse.
Okay.
And it's all about like what the music store experience used to be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like when you were a kid, you know, and you walked into your first music store, and it was, you know, like everybody says, kid in the candy store, but it was like... Yeah. Kid in the music store was the same thing. It's
Musicland, you know. Was my first one, Rock Spring,
oh,
Maryland,
okay.
Harford County. Joe Noto,
right?
Yeah,
right. Our good friend Larry just took over.
Ah,
he took over for his dad. His dad passed.
Yes,
you know, God
yeah.
bless.
Yes.
And Larry is taking over now.
Very cool.
Yeah, he left his current employment and is going to take over and try to fill dad's shoes.
Very cool. What was your first music store?
First. Big music store experience was probably, it was a place called Rondo Music on Route 22 in Union, New Jersey.
I've heard of that place.
For us, it was the Mecca. It was the place. It was pretty infamous, you know, or famous or whatever you want to
call it. I got you.
But my dad had taken me there when I, you know, started to learn how to make noise from all six strings on a guitar, you know, and bought my first new amplifier, you know, head and 212 vertical cabinet.
Really?
It was, we covered this the other day with somebody. It was the other Canadian company.
Yes.
Garnett.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which
That's
was
too
the,
cool. Randy Bachman's amp.
Now, was it a bunch of old salty dogs that have been on the circuit forever? The, you know, like we have a store here in Maryland, and well, we have two. We have Chuck Levin's, which is Washington Music.
Washington Music.
And then Bill's Music. And you go into Bill's even to this day, and you see some of those guys that have been there for 35 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and they're musicians, working musicians.
Yeah, and they're going to retire from there, or maybe never retire.
Never retire.
From there.
Yeah,
who
yeah.
knows?
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember too much about the sales staff in Rondo. And we had a couple of local stores in the Linden area. But, you know, Linden, home of Ampeg. Yay. Well, second home of Ampeg. You know, they moved from New York. To Linden. But, he was just mentioning how you walked in, and it was experienced people and players and, you know, how everybody kind of talked a different language, and the place, you know, smelled like music, you know? And
yeah.
It was, the corporate end of things, the megaliths of, you know, the stores, the big chains that we don't like to talk about, just kind of changed it after a while, and they hurt a lot of the little ones.
Absolutely, yeah. You know? I mean, we knew a couple of stores here that closed up that had been here. They were staples in that genre, and very sad.
I mean, Masters, you know.
Masters and Gordon Miller.
Gordon, yes, absolutely. Gordon Miller, the big chain came in.
Literally.
In the parking lot next door.
Yes.
Like the parking lot, not even on the other side of the street.
No.
Right next door.
Yeah. Like if you opened the door, or if you just went to the door, turned around, you saw the big chain store.
Yeah.
And what they did was, like a Home Depot, like any of those things that did, you know, when they did their thing to close up all the hardware stores, come in, drop the prices down next to nothing, have kind of a cool, eclectic kind of inventory. And then once the competitors are all gone, then they bring in the generic, you know, 500 Strats, all the Les Paul Studios and the standard SGs. And then you got the, you know, some Mesas, mostly Fenders, a lot of Line 6. It's the standard stuff. And then the prices go right back up. And you go, wow, you know.
Wish the other music store was still around.
Yeah, they used to sell Olympic basses over at the other place. Do you guys have Olympic basses? Oh, no, we can't get those.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we can get one from California.
Yeah,
and they're used.
We can order it for you.
Yeah, and they're used section. You know, so I agree that is not. I look at music differently, and I know you do too. It's not like, and Paul Shine. There's somebody here from way back, right?
Right.
Paul Shine was a sales guy at Chuck Levin's, Washington Music. Sorry.
Forever. Yeah.
Great guy because he wrote me a wife receipt. did not go over well, but he still did it. And you know, when you buy a $1,500 amp and he puts a $150 price tag on it, you got to thank a guy like that, right?
I just forgot a zero.
Exactly. So anyway, he told me one time, he said, here's the problem. If everybody could be a race car driver, nobody would want to be a race car driver.
True.
He said somehow, somewhere, somebody got this idea that if you made the Office Depot version of a music store, that everybody could be a musician. Well, nobody would want to be a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they bring in instruments that, you know, when a parent comes in, they go, $100 for an amp and a guitar? Well, I'll buy that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just, it takes the little guy right out of the equation.
Well, you know, it's not, I don't have a problem with the, well, I do have a problem where it comes from, but yeah. The idea of $100 or $150
for a starter, no,
for a starter, for a kid, but you know, you should be able to find that in your local brick and mortar mom and pop.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't take a chain to bring that to you. You know? You should be able to walk in. A kid should be able to walk in a good music store and go, I want to learn to play a guitar. And the offering should be there for him. And something. We all know that they've gotten better over the years where you can actually take it out of the box and it plays pretty well. It plays well enough to, you know, that you don't want to quit.
No.
But
now, but here's the thing, though. And this is where the big side does put the little guy out, because the little guy can't sell it for $99, but he can sell it to you for $135.
Mm-hmm.
Big guy can sell it for $99, and nobody goes to $135.
Well, see, that was another aspect of Joel's article here, that, you know, he said he would rather go and spend a few more dollars.
Yeah, well, yeah, I will.
In a regular, you know, mom and pop brick and mortar.
Sure.
Because of the expertise and the experience that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not only the experience of the store, the experience that the staff has, the expertise that the staff has, you know, the knowledge,
yep.
You know, if you're a road-worn player, even better, you know, because you can tell a guy, okay, this is going to be good for 6 months or a year, and then you want to move on to something else, and,
yep.
You know, and or maybe, you know, let me hear you play. Oh, you're better than that. Let me, you know.
I got a story.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So the only Paul Reed Smith that I've ever owned, I bought from a music store in Westminster, Maryland, Coffee Music.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, I overpaid for that guitar, literally by probably $300 to $400. I'm not kidding you. It had a $2,000 price tag on it for a PRS Standard 22. Those guitars probably sold for about $1,600 bucks, right? So I paid $2,000 for it. I didn't have a problem with that. And the reason was because I knew that $2,000 was going to pay those cats that work behind that counter every day that have been there for 20 years. And it'll keep the lights on in that place.
Right, right.
And it's like, you know what? I'll do that every time. Because honestly, yeah, it's more. I could go to the big chain place and get it for cheaper. But I can also go back in there and say to them and know that that guy's going to be there, you know, in some summertime hire. That guy's going to be there, and I can go to him. And when I come back in, hey, it's a greet by my name. Mm-hmm. You know, I get all of a sudden now I'm like part of that place,
yeah.
You know, and that right there is worth the price.
For sure. And there's, you know, as he concluded in his article, he's, and I'm glad, because he's one of the guys that absolutely still has his finger on the pulse of the industry. And he's seeing the resurgence of the, you know, the one off brick and mortars, or maybe two and three store, you know, and
sure.
It's coming back. They're, you know, and they're offering you a different experience now, because, you know, the whole chain thing got so cold that, you know, they're really nice stores that are starting to pop up, nice couches, lighting, you know, rugs, you know, the whole warm vibe, you know, the homey kind of vibe.
Sure.
And you can sit there and play some cool stuff and talk to some cool guys and you know, go back to what the experience used to be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, not with the cool lighting and the couches and everything, because we never had that.
No, never did. But there was cool dudes there.
There was cool dudes and a lot of cool stuff to play.
Yeah.
And you could sit down and they would help you, and you know, it's coming back. Supposedly it's coming back.
That's cool.
I'm really glad to hear that, you know.
Yeah, because the one thing that I noticed, too, is that, you know, some of these guys, you walk in. Now, with mom and pop, you know, you, like I said, you become like part of the family,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they treat you like a human. I noticed that some of the other places, oh, you're not in a local band that we know about. Okay, well, you know, and it's like, if you don't look like a dad, you're not getting paid attention to. And of course, you know, it kind of gets a little cliquish, you know,
mm-hmm.
like if you're not the flavor of the month that's out there gigging, they just, well, okay. Yeah, we'll get to you whenever, you know, because they got 100 stores. They don't need to,
right?
You know,
right?
You're not going to kill them.
No, try as you might, but
yeah.
So yeah, that was my little. I'm glad that they're seeing a resurgence of good music stores.
That and vinyl, God damn it.
That's right.
There both, you go, brother. Both.
Well, you know, on that note, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're going to come right back with our guest of the week. More girl power this week.
Yeah, man.
More girl power. And
hey, we look,
you know,
if you have three arms, we'll have you on.
That's that would be interesting. That would be interesting.
Yes,
but we'll be right back with our guest of the week. And who knows, maybe there's a music store story in there somewhere, so we'll find out.
Yes.
So we'll be right back with our guest of the week, Gretchen Mann.
Hey, this is Doug Rappaport here from the Edgar Winter Band, and you're listening to Amps and Axes.
And as promised, we're back, and with us, our guest for the week, Miss Gretchen Mann. Gretchen, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you guys?
We're doing well now. Yeah, we're doing great. We're doing great. How's you're on the left coast, right? How's things out there for you?
It's good. I was actually just out on the East Coast a couple of days ago.
Really? Where?
But yeah. Zepparella played in Brooklyn, and then we played at Mountain Jam, which was like in upstate New York.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good friends of mine were at Mountain Jam. I don't know if they saw you, but they were there.
Oh. There's a lot of good music to see, so I think you'd have to probably seek us out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, what's funny is that I was on the internet because that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I see this Zepparella thing, you know, on YouTube. And I don't realize that it's four women at first. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's four women.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, they're doing Led Zeppelin better than Led Zeppelin did live.
Oh, come on, Page and Plant did have their evenings.
Yes, they did.
They did.
And they had some other evenings.
Yes, they did.
Yes, they did. So, you know, so I was like, wow. So I started searching in, and then I saw this video, and we'll have to get to this because I know what you like to do.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this video, and I'm like, is that Stu Hamm playing bass? And then sure enough, it's Stu Hamm playing bass. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty, so, and yeah, we'll definitely have to get there, but
yes,
as I always like to do.
Yes, you do.
We're going to get in the Wayback Machine and go way back to find out where Gretchen came from and what put the music bug in your ear. So tell us a little bit about where Gretchen Mann came from.
Well, my whole family is quite creative. So I was born at Stanford Hospital, which is, you know, Stanford University mm-hmm. campus. My parents had moved out to that area, actually from Kansas City. My whole family's otherwise from Kansas City, so I'm sort of the first one to be born and raised in California. And my dad is a journalist. My mom's a psychologist, but like my mom's parents, like one of them was a painter, one was a poet and an actor.
Wow.
My dad's side of the family, a lot of people were musical. So even though I think there aren't that many people who've been professional musicians in the family, you know, I had a piano from the time I was born and piano lessons from, you know, the second I wanted them. And, you know, it was my parents played everything from reggae to Beethoven just when I was growing up.
Always music and arts in the house. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a lot of encouragement in that direction. You know, my parents weren't totally raging in the restrictive TV side, but they were pretty conscious of it. So even though we weren't like the, you know, we weren't the kids who weren't allowed to watch TV, that we meaning me and my sister, but my parents were always way more like, yeah, instead of TV, here's some here's some cool art supplies. So they like knew to get us really good art supplies or to encourage or to take us to plays so that then we would come home and want to do our own stuff. So we were always kind of encouraged to be creative in general, but it wasn't really, we were never pointed in a direction like you got to play this instrument or you got to do this or whatever.
Well, I mean, but I got to think that if a child is exposed to music and arts, and there's always music and arts around them, I think they're so much more inclined to gravitate towards that because I you know, from the way I feel about it, how could you not?
You know,
look, this is me speaking, and I have two girls, neither one are musical, but you know, I don't, maybe if I expose them to a lot more music and a lot more arts,
yeah,
they might be, I don't know, but it's just, if you don't get exposed to that, there's probably almost a zero chance that you're going to go into that, those kinds of fields.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, think about, like where I live, there's a lot of farmers.
Okay.
And their kids, they immediately, as soon as they can walk, talk, chew gum, they're out in the field.
Driving a tractor.
Driving and learn how to weld and everything else. And these kids, that's exactly what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you rarely every now and then one will do something different. But for the most part, so I guess having it in front of you all the time, it kind of just kind of, well, hey, that thing that I know sitting in the corner.
Right.
May as well just keep doing that.
Yeah, and then you know, parents are so inclined to help move that forward,
sure.
Shall we say? You know, if the child is inclined, because it's, you know, it's kind of
unless it's my father. You know.
Well, we don't have to go there.
Yeah,
we don't
have to go there.
That's a whole different show.
That's a dark show. That's a show where I cry a lot.
Oh, no. Oh, we won't go there.
Yeah, exactly.
Back on track. Anyway, so you always had a piano and there were always arts around. What was, I'm assuming since you said that, piano was the first instrument that you picked up, but I'm just assuming because maybe it's not.
Only in the way that any child who isn't, you know, Mozart or someone like that plays the piano at age 5, meaning like I sat down and I banged on it. And, you know, I wasn't like a super precocious little musical genius. I was like, I was a normal kid. We had an instrument in the house. I banged on it and then I played outside. And so I always loved music. And I had the requisite, I think, year of piano lessons where I remember having a book where my teacher would put stars in it and things like that. So, yeah, piano was my first instrument, as much as an instrument can be for a non-precocious, musically 5-year-old. I got more into music in 5th grade, and it was because we had music at my elementary school.
Nice.
And there was, like, one teacher, and he came in and he gave everybody a lecture on the different instruments. And that's how we were going to pick which instrument we played. So he's like, here's the violin. And he gave a little speech about the violin. And here's the clarinet. And he gave a speech about that. And he got to the very end and he's like, okay, so the hardest instrument is the flute. And he did this whole scare story on how it was the most difficult instrument, that most people couldn't even get a sound of it. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to play that. So I did it I played the flute for a few years specifically because the guy, you know, dared me to, as far as I was,
pretty much,
as far
yeah.
as I
wow.
was concerned.
Wow.
So I did that for like 3 years. I still have my flute. I found it the other day.
Nice.
But I don't remember any of the fingerings or anything. I can get a sound out of it, but that's pretty much it. So flute was what I did for like 3 years when I was about 10, 11, 12 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just did normal teenage things until I fell totally in love with the guitar, which is also, I guess, normal too in teenage. I just meant that I wasn't, you know, I was listening to a lot of music. I guess the phase between, you know, like my tweens and then like more like solidly in high school,
mm-hmm.
I think I was sort of, I was developing my musical taste. You know, I was...
And what was that based around?
Things that I loved, having been brought up, like, you know, going to the ballet, going to musicals and things like that. But that's when I was discovering my own music, stuff that I liked and wanted to listen to. That's when I, you know, was discovering lots of things. And because my dad worked for Guitar Player Magazine, which I didn't even really realize, I just knew him as a writer. I feel like as a kid, it's so easy to reduce your parents' profession to like the simple one word answer. Like, my dad is a banker. My dad is a writer.
He's a writer.
And so for me, my dad was always a writer.
Wow.
And I seem to remember that, you know, I do remember that like the stationery that we had at home, you know, with his name on it, had like a guitar, you know, this kind of artistic guitar symbol on it. And I knew it had something to do with guitar, but I was a kid. Like, I didn't really care.
didn't give much weight until I really
started getting into music that my dad was like, honey, do you know that I actually know something about this? And I was like, cool. So that's why I was really young when I discovered, like, you know, Django Reinhardt and Jeff Beck and Steve Morris and stuff like that, which really was not what most other 15-year-olds were listening to. But it was what I got into because my dad's like, oh, okay. You know, when I was in high school, all of the kids were, there was some kind of current music going on, you know, like it was grunge. It was like the grunge era. So, you know, the huge bands were Pearl Jam and Nirvana and stuff like that. But most of the kids in my school with some current music were listening to music of their parents' generation. So we were listening to AC/DC and Led Zeppelin and, you know, kind of classic rock.
Nice.
So when I started getting into that, my dad's like, oh, you like Led Zeppelin? Well, check out the Yardbirds. You want to know who Jeff Beck is? You know, oh, you like Eric Johnson? Well, have you heard of Steve Morris or whoever, you know, just, so it was kind of without pressuring in any direction. It was more like he had this great record collection and it was really easy for me to have something cool handed to me by somebody who had kind of pre-screened it and didn't have any ulterior motive at all. Like, neither of my parents ever thought, you know, ever gave me any indication as to what they thought I ought to do with my life other than that I should just explore options and figure out what I loved.
I mean, that is quite awesome. You know, I'm sure if you were going in a direction that they preferred you not go in, they may have said something, but just, you know, to leave it open to, you know, what, where your heart was going and what you felt comfortable with. I mean, that's great to have that opportunity given to you and then to be able to actually take that and do something with it. You know, I mean, not a lot of people get that chance, and that is really, really cool.
Now, when was your dad a writer?
Is he still a writer?
No. In fact, oddly enough, he had long since stopped being directly affiliated with Guitar Player magazine before I even picked up the instrument. I think he left when Guitar Player got bought out by Miller Freeman, a larger company, and so he left. He's now teaching at San Francisco State in the journalism department.
So he was there probably during the good years.
He left in like the early 90s or something, like before I even considered picking up a guitar.
Wow.
First issue that I ever saw, Pat Travers was on the front cover. It was like 1979.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. Go for What You Know Live came out.
He was there then for sure. Yeah.
That's
he
pretty
might
cool.
have even been editor then. He was editor for a short time because, you know, things were shifting around and he ended up like becoming like vice president and I think publisher of his, I'm pretty sure I'm right here. It just goes to show that I still reduce it to like, you know, the simplest thing to remember. He was at Guitar Player. I know he was editor in chief for a couple of years and I know he then got more involved on publishing and VP and stuff like that.
Wow. And his name?
Don Menn.
Okay.
That's pretty
he
cool.
He actually, the things that he did, I know that were kind of his babies is he did the Jimi Hendrix special issue that I think for a long time was like one of their best selling issues. And he also did a special issue on Frank Zappa.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's people that are really into Zappa are into not only music, you have to be into music and not just weird music because you got to be into a little bit of weird music, but like just extreme composition, just to, you know, like where is his brain coming from?
Yeah, it's bizarre.
It's where like Motown meets Stravinsky. Like I was actually just watching, I watched Petrushka last night because I actually happen to love Stravinsky. And I was remembering, I was like, wait a minute, because I have a lot of Zappa too. And I was like, wait, I'm sure that one of the early Zappa albums has a cover from Petrushka. And last night, it's funny you mentioned that, I was just thinking about how totally hilarious it is that somebody who, you know, for he's undefinable, but, you know, most people would consider him a rock musician, as much as the label really does not even begin to encompass right. actually his output. But let's just say it is. How many of them are covering Stravinsky?
Let me think.
Yngwie Malmsteen.
I'll get back to you next month, maybe. You know,
I think Vivaldi or Bach. I think of Yngwie very, very Baroque, but yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Well, anyway, you know, funny
Zappa
thing about
fanatics are fanatics indeed.
Oh, funny, sure. Funny thing about Zappa, from Maryland, from mm-hmm. Edgewood, Maryland.
Yeah. Yes.
I had a teacher that went to school with him in elementary school. My old English
really?
Teacher. Yeah,
oh,
man.
Oh, my God.
And they remained friends. And when he would come to the East Coast, Ken Smith, I think, is it Mr. Smith, if I remember correctly, he was my ninth grade English teacher. He was like best friends with Frank Zappa. When he would come to the East Coast, Frank would call him up. They would hang out. They would, you know, he'd get him mm-hmm. to the show and stuff. And they went fishing a lot.
Wow.
Frank Zappa fishing.
It's like Clapton fishing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he used to have a boat that was docked here in Annapolis yeah. for a while. But, I mean, didn't they just put up a statue to Zappa a few years ago
Maybe.
Around here?
Yeah, well, it had to be Edgewood. Oh. He went, yeah, it's and, where he lived.
Dweezil did Zappa Play Zappa.
Yes.
For it, yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so.
Which is, that was a crazy feat for Dweezil to do that.
Yeah.
He said that he had to go buy all the old equipment. Did you see the racks that he had for that show? It was 221U racks filled with equipment.
I think he's pared down now, and I think they actually sound better now.
Yeah.
You know, I heard some of the first attempts at Zappa Play Zappa, and I went, well, I know a local band that does some of this stuff better. But
with one-third the equipment.
Totally. But, hometown boy, so...
Yeah.
You know, cool. there's something weird in the water here. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you, let's see, your dad's writing. You did some piano. You did some flute, and then you finally hit guitar. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what your first one was?
Well, I do actually. I remember the first one that was mine. The first one I actually took a lesson on. And I don't even really count it because it was like, I went to school in Palo Alto. It's where Stanford is. They hammer it into your mind that if you don't have a 4.0, you're basically going to end up on the streets. And so I took a couple guitar lessons as seriously as somebody studies opera if they're singing in the shower, like during school. And that was on my dad's ESP. It was a Strat style ESP. So pretty much a total Strat copy mm-hmm. that was as like 80s as you get. It was like a purple pink burst and with all gold hardware.
Mm. Wow.
And I had a couple lessons on that. But then, so my dad became friends with the Ball family, Ernie Ball, because he started a column called What's in a Name mm-hmm. for Guitar Player magazine. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ernie Ball was the first person he featured in it. And so that kind of forged like a multi-generational connection with the family. The whole Ball family are just wonderful people.
Nice.
And when I first got interested in guitar, I wanted an Ernie Ball guitar. Like, that was the first one I want. Steve Morse had an Ernie Ball guitar, and I determined that I couldn't afford a vintage Fender Stratocaster like Eric Johnson played. And so I wanted an Ernie Ball guitar, and they took me to the factory, and I looked around, and I, you know, was all set to save my money and get it. And they gave me my first guitar. And
wow.
the one,
wow.
actually, if you've seen the video for Valentino's Victory Lap, that is my first guitar. I still have it, and it's why I'm loyal till the end of time to Ernie Ball. They were good wow. to me before I knew how to play a lick on the instrument, and
that
I always vowed
awesome.
That if I ever made anything of myself, I would be at their disposal permanently. So.
Wow.
That is very cool.
There's some allegiance there. But,
yeah.
I mean, and yeah, that is so cool because it just came out of a family relationship. And that's like sometimes mm-hmm. how the best things are cultivated.
Yeah.
You know, it's just mm-hmm. happenstance and this leads to this and that leads to that.
Do you want to know something crazy?
Always.
The only person that has left the artist line in guitars
Eddie Van Halen.
Is Eddie Van Halen.
Mm-hmm. Of left the Ernie Ball
Albert,
line.
Albert Lee. Steve Morse. I saw Steve Morse at a clinic. Locally, when Master Musicians used to be here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And one of the things he said, you know, you got to respect a guy like this. He says, I don't endorse anything I don't use. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. he said, they sat down with him, designed that guitar, because remember, he had a Telecaster. That was his guitar of choice. Yes.
It was a Frankenstein. It was a Telecaster with a Stratocaster neck.
Yeah, it was bizarre. When he was in the Dixie Dregs, you know, the early years. And then they took that guitar and pretty much made the guitar that he has today. And now they have a new version of Y2K or whatever, I think is what it's
called. Yeah, Y2D,
Oh, is that what it is? Okay. Wow. But they
Gretchen would know. She's tight with the balls.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Right.
She can call him up.
Right.
Well, you're talking about my favorite guitar is one of my favorite guitarists, so.
Oh, yeah. So Steve Steve is amazing.
He's totally. And there was, if I remember correctly, a strange pickup configuration
Very strange.
That thing, too, with a bunch of switches and everything. Yeah, the first time I saw the Dregs, I was like, who the hell is this guy? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
And he he does those weird things where it's like, you know, he'll do like 20 notes, very, very, you know, just a ton of soul in them and just, you know, these milky bends and then a flurry of 40 notes that just go blowing by and you're like, what was that?
And it lands somewhere between like country and fusion.
Yeah.
You know?
And
You can't even, you know, nobody's invented a word for his style yet.
Yeah,
him
and Dave LaRue is a dangerous pair right there, man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, the guitar that I wanted when I had not started playing guitar was a Steve Morse model. And Ernie and Sterling were like, no. I remember I told them that that's what I wanted. And they told me that I needed like a specific like advanced degree in electrical engineering to even understand how to work the pickups. And I'm like, okay, then the Silhouette sounds good to me.
That's really too many switches. You'll never get it to sound the way you want it to sound.
Yeah, I'll wait until I've got actually like, you know, the nuances of playing guitar down before I worry about geeking out that hard on the electronics.
Yeah,
well, just think who's offered that before they, you know, are even proficient enough for their dad to take them into the local music store and finally buy them a decent guitar. I mean, you got you know, Ernie and Sterling going, here, have a guitar.
Well, I know. I mean, in that sense, like, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people hear about that or see that and they just think what they just hear is privilege. And yeah, it's a huge amount of privilege. The flip side of it is that when you have that kind of just genuine appreciation and relation with people, the last thing I realized I would ever do is ask them for anything, like ever. Like, you know, I've never been one of the artists that was like, hey, here's what I'm doing, or hey, check this out. The way I saw is that, like, they had my number. If they ever wanted anything from me, they knew where to find me. And so I've always kind of approached things really carefully. And there's also been, you know, a huge amount of not for any pathological neurotic reason, but a desire to feel like, God, I've had so much handed to me. Like, maybe I shouldn't fuck it up. You know, like maybe I should really, really try to reach as far as I can and grow as much as I can and be constantly evolving, because like who has had it easier in certain respects? Mm-hmm. So, and I do have just a tremendous amount of respect and, you know, appreciation for that which has been given to me that isn't available to everybody.
Right.
Having said that, that doesn't make you a good guitar player.
Like, no.
You know, if connections could make somebody a good guitar player, I'd be a lot better than I am.
Yeah, I mean, that is awesome. And I love the respect that you have for them. And I never meant to infer any sort of privilege or anything in what I said. I just, you know, it was just a very cool aspect
it's true, you know, though, it happened. Who gets a guitar handed to them before they even know how to play? Like, you know, it was an incredible gift.
True. So where did you take it from there? What happened next?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had no aspirations of becoming a professional musician. I didn't even think it was possible because I was 19 when I really started playing. And what had happened is, again, as I said, it gets hammered into people who grew up in Palo Alto that if you don't get a 4.0, that you're going to not get into any colleges and you're going to be out on the street and you're going to be a social pariah and all of that stuff. It's just it's an academic town.
You'd be living in a van down by the river.
exactly. And so, and not to mention the fact that it is not cheap to live around here.
Right.
So, I did what I think a lot of other people did, which is I totally stressed out and I worked like crazy in high school. And so what happened is I went to college. I applied to a ton of different places, certain I was going to get rejected by all of them, but actually ended up with some good options. And then I ended up going to school at Smith College in Massachusetts, which is like a liberal arts school.
Wow.
And what ended up happening is I went there fully intending on either being like an English or a sociology major. And right about midway through my first semester, I had my guitar with me. I actually had gone to the local music store to buy an amp, and I didn't know how to play enough to actually demo anything out. So I just had the guy at the music store demo stuff for me. And he came across one, and I was like, that's the one that sounds good. He's like, well, okay, you got good taste. It was a 66 Fender Deluxe Reverb. And I'm like, okay, wow. You know, how much do I need to give you for it? And I don't remember what it was. It was, you know, a reasonable price, but I didn't have the money. So I came back like every week and just gave him like $20 or $40, like anytime I had the money. And I think he actually let me take it when I had paid like $450. And he was like, okay, just take it. It's yours. maybe he was just tired of me showing up, giving him like little bits of money piecemeal.
You got to love the old school payment plans.
Here's how it works.
Yeah.
If it would have been me, I would have paid every cent. It would have been paid that day.
Right.
You know, the chick walks in, if has any interest, she gets to pay $20. And then when it gets to about half of it, he'll go, I'll just eat the rest.
It was a really tiny store that probably made one sale every few months. So it seriously might have been just something like they just wanted to, you know, to be done with it and bring in another item because it was tiny. It was like the size of a living room.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, it's called Blue Note Guitars. It's not there anymore, but it was by the Iron Horse in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Nice.
So I got that. I had those things. But like I said, I knew enough guitar to not even be able to demo an amp, at least not properly. And I had heard, I was thinking about taking guitar lessons, but I didn't really know where to start. And I had heard that the classical guitar teacher who taught for the five colleges, because it's Smith, Mount Holyoke, Amherst, UMass, and Hampshire colleges. And it was one classical teacher who was reputed to be just phenomenal beyond words. And his name is Philip DeFremery, and he was a student of Segovia. And I remember somebody telling me that he was this amazing teacher and all of his students developed perfect technique. And I thought, okay, sign me up for perfect technique. I'm down with that. So I started taking... So my first real formal training with guitar was classical guitar. And I started studying with Philip DeFremery. And within, you know, a couple of lessons, I totally had the bug. I just loved it. And I started taking music theory classes. So because of all the academic, you know, OCD stuff that I had done in high school, I found out that Smith College recognized advanced placement credits as college credits. So I was told midway through my first year that I actually had enough credits to graduate a year early.
Nice.
And wow. I was like, oh, that's awesome. I didn't even realize that I was doing that. I just thought I was taking these classes, you know? And so I was like, yeah, I'd be totally stoked to save $30,000. That sounds good to me. So I opted to graduate a year early, but then that meant that I had to declare my major essentially immediately.
Mm.
And I've always said it's interesting what you learn about yourself when you're put on the spot, you know, because I think of myself as being, you know, very reasoned and, you know, like thoughtful and not necessarily making rash emotional decisions. And in the moment, I realized that what I wanted to study, that what my heart wanted was to learn more about music, that it had become my favorite language and I couldn't wait to try to develop a little bit of fluency. So I declared a music major, as much as my parents have been totally supportive, I think it's a different thing when your kid becomes a music major at a college like Smith. Smith is quite a good school. And you think, wait a minute, like you're going to Smith and you're going to study music? Why? Like, you know, the music industry was in the toilet before I even thought about playing guitar. So,
the commercial music industry. I mean, there's still, you know, instructors. Yeah. There's still classical.
Could have went to Berkeley.
Could
have rubbed elbows with John Petrucci.
Well, absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And you'd be closer to home.
Right. But But I loved the education I got there. And actually, I was kind of, I realized that in terms of things like rock, like I was fine with getting my own education in that. And I liked actually going and studying classical guitar from, I mean, not only do I love it, and I loved it then, and I feel like the instruction I got was just some of the best that I've ever even heard of. Phil DeFremery is just an amazing guitar player and a truly gifted teacher as well.
Wow.
That between that and also a really solid, well, you know, a degree in music, you know, theory and harmony and all of that was just the right thing for me, because I knew no matter what, like, I was always going to be listening to and learning rock music. I didn't, you know, and furthermore, it just seems to fit more my, how I relate to both genres. I think it would feel really strange to study rock music in a classroom. It doesn't mean it's not right for some people, but to me, I felt like studying classical music and 20th century music and romantic music in a classroom just felt like a better fit with the way that I related to that type of music. Rock music I wanted to do kind of on my own and outside of the classroom.
That's very cool. I mean, to get a well-rounded music education, I think it's a wonderful thing.
Sure.
And I've got a question. It just popped into my head. I never really thought of it before, but with such intense music knowledge about composition and harmonies and things like that, do you just subconsciously or unconsciously, or, you know, do it and then hate doing it, or do it and love doing it? Do you like overanalyze a lot of the music that's out there? You know, do you pick it apart and are not able to appreciate it as much as someone who just loves music and doesn't know what's going on inside it?
You know, I know some people say that's something that they're worried about, and in some cases that they've experienced. Fortunately, it's not the case for me. I feel like the more I learn about virtually everything, the more I appreciate it. And the best way I can put it in terms of classical versus rock music, and I'm not sure how this is because I didn't grow up bilingual, but, you know, they talk about kids who grow up bilingual, they never really confuse the two languages. I feel like that's the closest analogy I can come for me. When I'm playing Led Zeppelin, I'm not thinking about secondary dominance or proper resolution. I'm certainly not thinking about voice leading, because from that perspective, one of the things that makes rock sound like rock is totally antithetical to the way that voices move in classical music. So it's like, why even apply that there? It's a waste of time, and it's analyzing something based on a totally different set of conventions. So
that's interesting.
That's what I always say.
that is very well said, very well thought out, and very well said.
No, thank you, because I do that all the time. Yeah. I was just saying that, you know, I was talking.
Oh, did you say something, Mick?
Yeah. I was talking to my dog today, and I said, you know,
No, that's very well, eloquently said, and very well thought out.
Absolutely.
And really nice to hear that.
Yeah.
You know, you.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. It's, you know, you're not, I mean, for lack of a better term, but maybe this is the perfect term, jaded, because, you know too much, and you know why this probably sucks in the real world of composition and harmonies and all this. You know, this is a piece of crap, but it's a you know, classic rock song.
He was obviously high.
Well, you know?
Yeah. Well, but you know, on the flip side of it, like, yeah. There's plenty of stuff that classical music can't touch rock in. You know, it's like they provide different things. And yeah, rock music has a level of danger that at least most classical doesn't. I mean, sometimes you can get it, maybe in the time it did, but by virtue of being classical, it means it's been around for a long time. It means it's been vetted a long time. It means it's been played a number of times. So if an orchestra is playing something that's a very dangerous work by Stravinsky, they are rehearsed as, like, so rehearsed. You know, a rock band coming up with something that, forget about it, whether or not it's complex, but it's new, it's immediate, it does have an element of danger. And the other thing is that you're not talking about writing music and outsourcing it to a conductor and a ton of people who are virtuosic in their instrument. You're talking about the people who are writing the music are also playing it and performing it and arranging it, you know, and you're talking about people who end up multitasking to a degree that is totally unheard of in the classical world. So,
wow.
I don't know. I feel like,
it's an interesting
I feel like
take.
Music snobbery is one of the most, you miss a lot of good stuff. with snobbery. It's just, it's being closed off. I mean, in both rock and classical music, isn't one of the most valuable things having open ears and open mind? Like, why limit what you can enjoy?
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
My old music teacher, Alan Dean, who played trumpet for Otis Redding, he went to Peabody, and he said for the longest time he was like a jazz snob. And then he met some other guys, and they've been on the road for 25 years, and all of a sudden his eyes opened up a little bit because they kind of handed his ass to him. and told him, you know, there's other things in the world besides your jazz.
Right.
And nice. Well, you know what's interesting? I was just talking with somebody about this with jazz the other day because I also happen to love jazz. And it's funny, while I do totally support the idea that purists are what help keep things, you know, alive in the form that they first originated, but the very spirit of jazz was totally revolutionary. It wasn't snobby, you know? So it's kind of funny how something that, you know, 100 years ago was an absolute, like, wild revolution has now become this thing that's, like, uptight and staunchy. I mean, and the same thing happened in classical music. Beethoven's Third Symphony blew people's minds. Stravinsky's Rite of Spring ended Nijinsky's career. You know, it's like people had riots because of the stuff that now we sit and we get dressed up and we clap very politely at the right moments for. Yeah. You know?
Well, it's called being American. Right. We can screw up and make anything bad. we're good at that.
That's funny. Wow. Yeah, there's a whole different degree of perception and, you know, what used to be radical. I mean, look at the beginning of rock and roll. It used to be so radical, you know, and you can't show Elvis's hips. I mean, you know, come on.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing, just 100 or 200 years prior, you know?
Exactly.
So
that's cool, man.
Well, okay, so you're taking lessons, and you're finally, you've got a guitar, you got an amp, you finally are hoping to figure out what to do with these. So what was your first, of garage band, band of college friends? I mean, there had to be something that developed somewhere around this time, I would think.
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, what I found was one of the weirdest challenges for me was actually figuring out how to be in or play in a band. And I feel like that's like the biggest downfall about starting a little bit later that had I started in high school a little bit more seriously, then I would have been playing with other people at my school. But by the time I was in college, okay, so Smith is an all-girls school. Now, that doesn't mean people weren't playing music, but I mean, as you know, women in rock music are not, you know, don't represent half. So so I think that when it comes to like having figured out how to even meet other musicians, how to play together in a band situation, that happened a little bit later. And my first experience with it was when I was playing, I was on break for a summer, and I started playing jazz and like mostly jazz standards with some really talented high school students. They were, I guess, at that point a year or two younger than I was, which meant that I was the geriatric person of the group. but we played like jazz standards, which is kind of hilarious to me. That was like my first band. Like, I'm not a jazz player at all. I love it. I've studied little bits and pieces of it, but any actual jazz player would laugh me out of a room. So so that was my first gig, and that was a band. Wow. I think we called ourselves Sketch, and we actually even played gigs and stuff.
Huh. Wow. Okay, that's a first for us, I think.
Yeah.
The player's first band was a jazz gig.
Yeah.
I think that's a first for us.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm that's going back in the database.
Green Dolphin Street.
That's pretty crazy.
Wow.
So, you know, paying gigs, that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. The problem was, is we were too young. None of us were old enough to play in bars. So we, that limited a little bit where we could play.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we did do a couple of gigs, hilarious as it was.
Nursing homes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Restaurants.
Of course.
The mall. You can play in the mall, you know.
Totally.
The youth club. I don't think they're Why are you guys playing jazz? Don't you know any Pat Benatar?
Exactly. So what? Right. I mean, where did the transition happen, and you finally go, you know, I'm a rock chick, and I'm going to start playing rock music, and you know, whether it's with guys or all chicks, or you know, how did right. Where was the next step?
Well, I've always been equal opportunity in my social life. Like, solidly half my friends have always been guys, and then I think it was really right after I graduated, and I was like, okay, you know what? I'm so glad to know classical, to be studying classical guitar, and I'm really happy that I have this basis in music theory. But when you're talking about what any normal guitar player brings to the table, it is not how to properly resolve a French augmented six chord. Like, nobody cares if you can do that in a band situation. It does not matter at all, you know? But it's a question of, like, can you play over a blues? And I didn't know how to do that. You
wow.
know, it's like,
yeah.
I could analyze a piece, or I could, you know, I wrote a string quartet at my senior year. Not, I mean, it's not like a great string quartet or anything like that, but I did that. And so I resolved that I needed to play in a rock band. And so right around that time, I got called by, you know, a group of girls who were playing AC/DC. And they said, we need an Agnes Young. And so I
nice.
Was like, okay, well, that hits on the right levels. Plus, I loved AC/DC. And all I asked is, I said, I don't have to do the strip, right? So, like, no, we don't do the strip. So I didn't do the strip. But I got because I realized that rock guitar, playing gigs, that was part of the thing that I wanted to do. Is I'm like, this is ridiculous. I have a degree in music, and I don't know how to do a sound check. You know, I lacked all practical real world experience.
Wow.
And the last thing I wanted to be was like a little academic princess who was like, oh, wait, what's a monitor? So I got to be Agnes Young for a couple of years. With AC/DC and play a bunch of gigs. And they're still around, actually. I think they are. The best thing for me that came out of that, other than just the, you know, paid education factor to it, was I met Clementine. She was the drummer, and she and I formed, like, you know, what has now been a really lasting, my most long-lasting musical connection, friendship, you know, bandmate. Like, we've been in a number of projects together. She's the drummer of Zeppelin. Zeppelin was her idea.
So oh, nice. Her name wasn't Phyllis Rudd?
Phyllis Rudd, yes. We had Bonnie Scott and Riff Williams.
Oh my God, it was Phyllis Rudd.
That's great.
Oh, that's too funny.
That is great. So, so when you started this, was it gear correct too? I mean, I realize you didn't have to go topless and put the little boy shorts on, but you know, was it gear correct?
I had a 61 Les Paul SG. So the one that Les Paul was like, this is not a Les Paul,
right,
but it was
right.
before they were calling it an SG. So I had a historic Gibson reissue of that. I still have it.
Wow.
I got the Marshall that I actually still have now, which is a 1976 JMP.
Wow.
There you
and
go.
A Marshall cabinet. So yeah, and I used no pedals other than a tuner, which I believe is also Angus correct.
Girl went for the real deal, man. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like, again, I've never played in a rock band. Like, what else would I have done? I didn't know. Like, I even if I had wanted to be like different or rebellious, I wouldn't have even known where to start. So why not start with exactly what I'm supposed to use? And besides, like, you know, when you're dressing like the band and duck walking like Angus and rolling on your back, it's like, what am I going to have a different amp? Why? And actually, I lucked out. I've had really good luck with amps for no reason that I can tell. I tend to have really great amps, and the one that I got was actually sight unseen from a guy up in Portland, and I took his word for it, and he was honest. It's been a great amp.
Wow.
Yeah.
So. I imagine the whoever was what would be the girl name for Malcolm?
It was Mallory.
Mallory. Mallory Young. I'm sure
there's
she
a
was.
A lot of thought that has to go in there. It's almost like a bad porno tape. you know, AC/DC.
The names came with the band. The band had existed prior to me. They were, I guess, their previous Agnes.
Oh, that's
too
funny.
Left or something mm-hmm. like that. So.
And now they have another replacement Agnes, I would assume. Okay.
Yes, yeah. exactly.
It's like the Ramones.
Right.
Everybody's
right.
a Ramone.
Nobody was Joey or Dee Dee or, you know.
You're just the next Ramone.
Right. But, well, they only had four Ramones, though, I think, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they ever had replacement Ramones.
Oh, there was guys that came in after, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, the drummer, I think the drummer changed out. Oh, and maybe the bass player. Well, Dee Dee, I think, left the band at some point or something. I can't remember. It's a full history about the Ramones. That's another story.
Ramones, they turned into Kiss then.
Yeah, so. It just became
I was just going to say Kiss.
Yeah, it became exactly. this thing, you know.
Right.
Wow. That's pretty cool, though, that you went straight in.
Yeah.
And in that respect, it was something where my gender really helped me, which is, like, probably not a lot of other, you know, there weren't a lot of other people who they could have even called for the gig. And so though I was inexperienced, actually, here's the good thing about having a classical background is it means that if I need to learn something literally, I learn it literally. You know, so they were wanting to do everything exactly note for note. I wouldn't have known how to do it any other way. Ah. Like, it was like, hand me sheet music. I will learn it.
Interesting.
And
that's
so
pretty cool.
It was, yeah. But it was my first experience of to any serious degree. I had learned stuff off records or off albums by ear. Previously, but it was the first time I actually had to sit down and learn every single note, not just the ones that I decided I wanted to learn.
Nice.
So now you know every Chuck Berry lick.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's AC/DC. Just spit
it
out.
Is.
Now, did you know when you went into from there to do Zeppelin covers? At that point, had you decided? To learn every Jimmy Page lick ever written and then form this other band? Or was the basis of the band, let's form the band and then I'll learn everything I need to know about Jimmy Page?
Well, okay, so it's funny. Clementine and I have totally different memories of how the band started.
Cool.
I'll tell you my memory of it. I'm sure it's somewhere, you know, somewhere in the middle. Zeppelin was like what I listened to in high school. I mean, AC/DC as well, but I loved Led Zeppelin. And actually, I think I had learned one or two of the tunes before. Not all the way through, not the way that I would need to learn them to play them on stage. But, you know, I think I learned, like, you know, the riff of Black Dog. And I think I actually learned some of the Rover. That was one of my favorite Zeppelin songs.
Yeah, it's a cool song.
And so my memory was AC/DC was offered a tour to open for Reverend Horton Heat. Clementine and I really wanted to do it, but some of the other girls in the band had like conflicts or somehow it didn't work out. And Clementine and I were totally heartbroken. And I remember her like just banging on the steering wheel as we're driving to a gig, just the two of us, and saying like, I wish there was another, like that I could start another band such that when AC/DC isn't available for things that at least I could provide an alternative. Because I think that's what it was, is that Clementine and I were excited. I mean, she had actually toured the world with her metal band, Bottom. And so I was the total baby of AC/DC and the green one. And Clementine was like the road warrior. And she wanted to play. And I wanted to learn. And so she's like, I just have always wanted to do like Led Zeppelin music. And I was like, well, okay, I don't know if you would ever consider letting me audition if you ever decide to do something like that, but I love Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin every bit as much as AC/DC, and I don't want to say more, but it has like a more broad spectrum, you know, so from a guitar perspective, there's more to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, oh, no, you're in the band if you want to be. And I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Let's do this.
And so, yeah, and so she handed me 15 songs and booked our first gig for 8 weeks in the future. And I was living in San Diego at the time, and she and the other girls were in Northern California. So I had 8 weeks to learn 15 songs. And in the first group of songs, there was Heartbreaker, Since I've Been Loving You, and the Lemon Song.
Nice.
And I remember calling her at one point and being like, Clementine, this one measure of Since I've Been Loving You has 60 notes, 60 notes in one measure. She's like, it's okay, you can do it.
My hand just stops after 59. I can't do it.
It's all right. You can do it.
That's
I like that.
That is too cool.
So that's sort of how Zeffirella was born.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you play a Les Paul in that, right?
Yeah, Les Paul. I do. And that was never a slight to Music Man. Because, I mean, the thing to keep in mind is I had been, at that point, I didn't have any relationship with Music Man beyond just the fact that they had been awesome to me and given me a guitar. But at that point, I would have been an utterly inappropriate endorser. I had been playing in rock bands like 2 years at that point. I didn't know any, I still don't know anything, but I really didn't know anything then. And so, especially when you're talking about a tribute band where your gear is totally mandated by the project, and frankly, as much as it shouldn't necessarily be the case, I think the band probably would have suffered had I not played the appropriate gear. Even though Jimmy Page definitely did play a Telecaster, that's not what he's iconic for. Like, when you think of Jimmy Page, you're not picturing a Telecaster, probably.
Right. I mean, some of the tribute bands do break out the telly for the early stuff.
Well, that would be Get the Let Out.
Get the Let Out does that, right?
Yeah. They go crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got the pedals to emulate things that were done on the recordings, and then of course the back line is very expensive.
Yeah, it's just walls of stuff. Do you use the same Marshall, the same 76, for the Led Zeppelin band now?
You know, for the longest time I did, and I still have it with me. But recently, I have stepped out a little bit from what Jimmy's gear would have dictated, and I've been using a Two Rock Bionix.
Okay.
Which is, I could not overstate how much I love that amp. To me, it has everything that I love about the Marshall. And actually, my guess, and I'm maybe totally talking out of my ass here, but especially some of the older Marshalls, because technically I shouldn't have a JMP, I should have a Plexi. And right. I always tell people I am fully accepting gifts of old vintage gear, should anybody want to purchase vintage gear. But so far, no. So far, I've received zero Plexis. And also, I feel like I'd rather than get totally geeked out on gear, I'd rather focus on just becoming a better guitar player. You know, I have stuff that works. Anything that isn't sounding right, it's not the fault of the gear. So I've been.
Wow, she's not a real guitar player.
You know what? You know what would have been funny if she would have said, "Well, I'm using an angle Powerball," which is like total metal.
Exactly. Well, I did have an Engel that I was using for a while for some of my solo stuff. The Two Rock, what I'm loving about it is that I feel like it's just a great amp for me. You know, if there was just one great amp, then everybody would have the same amp.
True,
but. Yeah. You know, we all have different attacks. You know, ultimately tone, I think, really comes from our ears and our fingers and just that we find the way that we need to get our gear to give us the sounds that we're looking for. And some gear gives it to us easily, and some gear we have to fight, and we tend to gravitate towards the gear that we don't have to fight.
True.
So,
yeah, true.
You know, for me, the first time I plugged in and played the Two Rock, I'm like, oh my God, this is the Holy Grail amp for me. So I've been playing that. I have received zero complaints, and in fact, a lot of people are like, "Oh my God, the amp sounds great!" So, so I am using a Two Rock Bionix now, but I do still have my Marshall, and I'm not getting rid of it.
Cabinet, Marshall cabinet, or is it a Two Rock cabinet? Or
actually, it's a Two Rock cabinet as well.
Oh, nice,
cool.
Yeah.
Now, the Engel, is that a Steve Morse model?
No, it isn't. It's a special edition 670 with EL34s. Steve Morse was using for a while before they gave him his own signature model. And I think he also had Powerballs. I'm not sure.
I don't know. Yeah, but I know.
They have
I was
going to
say he has his own signature model
and,
now.
And
so.
Everybody speaks German.
Right.
Right. I'm just remembering something because I did a little bit of research and I think this might be right. But
okay.
somewhere in your life and in your career, you weren't doing music for a while.
You had
a different career.
We skipped that part. Okay, so I forgot to mention that part. Okay, so because I graduated a year early from college, which I hadn't expected, because I followed my heart and got a degree in music, one of the things that you realize when you're in that situation is you're like, oh my God, I have a degree in music and I have been playing guitar for 2.5 years. Like, this is this is a little backwards. And not just that, but the main thing that really dawned on me is I noticed how many people around me, great musicians, had become incredibly jaded and very bitter and had a lot of negative things to say about music. And I realized that it all came from the music industry, and it all came from one simple thing, which is the necessity of making money by doing what you love to do. And that when that doesn't come easily, which it really doesn't, except for in very rare cases, you risk tainting your passion. And not only that, but in the very least, you will always be making artistic decisions from a financial place, at least to some degree. And so I thought, okay, I'm lucky enough to have a passion. A lot of people don't have a passion. And how do I protect that? And so I thought, all right, easy enough. I'm going to have a second career. And I'm not going to ever expect to make a dime playing music, because I don't want to play pop music. I don't want to play the type of music that's actually making money now. So what if I go into the music industry, absolutely knowing the music industry is tough, and what if I don't go in it for any reason other than because I just love music and I expect nothing else from it other than that I want to just grow as a musician? Nice. And so with that in mind, I was like, okay, but then what do I do? Like, I had worked a summer like at a bar, like I wasn't old enough to serve drinks, and so I was like the there were pool tables there, so I was like the girl who, like, guys in people who were there, like I gave them their balls. So so I realized that drained me of my will to live, and it was horrible, and I spent a summer not practicing at all. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I needed to do something that was more interesting or more challenging. And I had taken a couple of flight lessons totally capriciously while I was in school, simply because I had encountered a sign that said discounts available at the local airport for college students, you know, 3 flights for $99. And it was right over in the winter. And I'm like, I know, I'm probably going to get some money from my parents for Christmas. I'm going to take flying lessons because that would just be cool. Mm-hmm. So I just did it because it sounded cool. And because I've always loved roller coasters, and I've been one of those people where when there's turbulence on a plane, I'm excited because it reminds me that I'm in the air as opposed to being like a white knuckle flyer. And so I took 3 lessons and I was like, this is awesome. And I wanted to take more. But then I was like, what am I thinking? I'm a college student. I'm getting deeper and deeper into debt. Like, this is a very bad decision. So what I just did is I would go up flying whenever I got a little bit of money. But then what I realized, it kind of dawned on me as I was looking at graduating that I knew how much my flight instructors made because I was paying them. And that I was taking lessons when they told me they were available. And I thought, wait a minute, it isn't like I'm practicing. I mean, some people I know practice 9 hours a day, but you know, I've been more in the about half that category because I just find that I have more concentration. I find that I get to a point of diminishing returns.
Sure, sure.
And that having a full life actually, I don't know, fuels creativity for me better. And so I was like, wait a minute, I could totally be a flight instructor and also, you know, and have that be my day job. And so I went to flight school right after college, and I got all my flight instructor ratings, and I started teaching flying. And so that's how I started supporting myself and, you know, being a big kid. And then I got hired by the airlines, and then I did that for a year. And I was flying for Continental Express, and I was based out of Cleveland. Wow. And I loved flying, and I loved flight instructing. But I did not like flying for the airlines at all.
It was
a really boring type of flying for me. And I realized that I was flying this great little, it was these brand new jets. They were Embraer 145 and 135 regional jets.
They were
the slickest, trickest, like brand new all glass cockpit planes. So I could not have been hired into a cooler plane.
You were flying jets?
Mm-hmm. I was, yeah.
Good God, how many hours do you have? How many hours do you have?
I got hired on to them with, I think, about 2,000 hours.
Oh my
I'm not sure how many I have now. It's been a while since I've been flying, but I still keep renewing my flight instructor's license.
You are Steve Morse. Because he's got...
Or B.B. King or Mark Knopfler or Dick Dale. I think they... isn't B.B. King was a pilot, wasn't he?
I don't remember who he was.
I don't know.
And so was David Gilmour.
Wow.
I think there's a similar guitar pilot personality.
Wow.
Interesting.
But yeah. I don't know.
I read that. I went, this is just too cool.
That is very cool. I thought you were like flying Cessnas.
You were flying jets. Too. And you know what? For the record, Cessnas are a hell of a lot more fun than the jet I was flying. The jet was nicer. There are nice planes and there are fun planes. Nice planes don't actually need you to be flying them, yeah. Whereas the fun planes are the ones that you actually have to work with a little bit.
Nice.
Yeah, Cessnas can fall out of the sky. So.
Well, see, now we have the entire story of Gretchen, and you know when the
that's the craziest thing,
when the Amps and Axes entity gets to be the biggest podcast in the universe,
yes.
She can fly our corporate plane for us.
That would be awesome.
You know,
she can fly us to a gig. That would be it.
And
be
we
could
just all jam together afterwards.
Yeah, it's
done.
Absolutely.
And here's the cool part, I can take over the controls during it because she's an instructor.
Oh!
Oh, it's true. It's actually true. No. I think. Well, no. Actually, you don't have to be type-rated. I'm not sure about the restrictions in terms of corporate stuff because I've never flown corporate. But are you? Are you a student pilot?
Oh no,
not yet.
Soon to be.
Soon to be. Who knows?
I've raced cars.
There you go.
Oh, well,
it's like
go.
It's like an airplane without wings.
Right. The plane's like a car without wheels most of the time.
Exactly.
I think you get a better sense of acceleration in cars, though, which is really why we all do it, right?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
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 Getting away from the gravity a little bit with the plane. As you lose,
yeah, when the jet takes
perception.
Off, though, I kind of go, oh. Oh, I get, I white knuckle.
Do you? Are you a white knuckle flyer?
Nah.
Well, you know, the thing is I've been on the, what is that thing called? The Fokker? That mm-hmm. There's one called the Fokker. Mm-hmm. It's a German-made prop plane that they use to puddle jump. We took it from Miami to Key West, and then we took one from Dublin to another place in Ireland.
Okay.
And I remember this plane. And that was actually better for me.
Oh, really?
Than a jumbo jet type plane. Because I look at those things, and I'm like, this is the biggest, slowest pig on the planet. Like, if this guy wants to turn, he needs literally 40 miles to turn his thing around, where this Fokker can actually flip upside down.
Well, and you've pretty much pinpointed exactly why I will defend a Cessna, at least in terms of being fun to fly, over
it's
you
like
know,
a
the
sport
Embraer
bike.
Regional jet.
Yeah,
yeah, I'd rather be a passenger on the Embraer regional jet. And airlines are made for passengers, not for pilots.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was just, I just, that's why I don't, you know, I always like the smaller planes because I just like, well, this guy could maneuver this thing.
Right, right.
You know?
It takes a little more talent and, you know, the guy might be in for a little excitement now and then.
Yeah, plus there isn't as many movies with like smaller planes where the guy's going, I can't hold it. But, you know, it's always like some 737, 740, uh-huh. And the guy's like, and it's forever to hit the ground.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, half of the movie has to be the plane falling exactly. from the sky, you know.
So
yeah, and there's no snakes on the Cessna or anything, you know.
You can pretty much get them all.
There you go. Well, I think we've come full circle here, or at least to the different, the end of a different circle.
Yeah.
Or something.
Now this solo album, though.
We got to touch that. And,
yeah.
And where you're playing and what are you doing now.
Oh, yeah.
So. And your gear.
Yeah, absolutely. What did you want to start with?
Well,
all of it.
Yeah, that would be great.
Solo stuff.
Yes. How did you hook up with Stu Hamm?
Yeah.
Okay, so Stu Hamm, he's also a local guy, or at least he was for a while. I think he might be down in LA now. So I became friends with Jude Gold, who's an amazing guitar player himself. He's now playing with Jefferson Starship, but he also does solo stuff. And interestingly enough, he works at Guitar Player Magazine, mm-hmm. never with my dad. But we became friends because our bands, he was playing in a Van Halen tribute band. I was playing in Zeppelin. And it was one of those things that like, oh my gosh, I had heard about him and I knew him or I knew of him. And we finally met and we became instant friends. And we were both trying to work on albums at the same time. And we said, hey, let's kind of partner to help each other out. You know, like if you have a workout buddy. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, let's like give each other accountability. Let's set deadlines. Let's make this happen. So when it came time for me to figure out who was going to play on the album, Jude had been the one guitar player for the B3 tour, you know, with Stu Hamm and Billy Sheehan and Jeff Berlin. Jude's nice. Like an incredibly versatile guitar player, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, what if we ask Stu? And I was like, sure. Yeah. Stu wants to play on my album. Stu can play on my album. And actually it was a really good lesson in asking for what you want. You know, I think so often people just assume that something would be totally unattainable, but it's like by believing it to be unattainable renders it so. So I was like, okay,
true.
You know,
absolutely.
If Stu Hamm asks, you know, or if I ask Stu Hamm and he says no, it's exactly the same as if I don't ask him. So I'll just ask him. And he said yes. So Stu Hamm's on my album.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. That's very cool.
Well,
yeah, I mean, my gosh, he's like,
you don't know
if
you don't
ask. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, he plays with my heroes. My God. You know, I definitely had the, I'm not worthy. But nothing like feeling not worthy to absolutely make you work harder to maybe hopefully over time you become a little bit less unworthy.
True. Nice guy.
Yeah. Oh, super nice. Really funny.
Cool. Yeah. I've seen him with,
Joe Satch.
Satch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, a couple mm-hmm. of the, G3.
Yeah. Tours. He used to play, and forgive me if I say it wrong, a Kubicki.
Yes.
Bass. It was a headless bass and, had a weird looking body to it, but now he plays more of a conventional.
Was that the Factor?
Factor. Yeah. It had a drop D tuner, but it was weird. It was like a lever that would come down and actually fret the string. So it actually had extra frets on the low,
The E. Like below the nut or something.
Well, the nut was moved outward, so string was longer than the other three, and you would flip that lever, and it would go down to a D. So it was not even like you were doing it to a tuner key. It was literally like there was a finger holding it, and then you just release it. Pretty cool invention.
Yeah, that's
if you really think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah. I had the pleasure to see Satch with Stu Hamm.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember his bass solo was amazing. Because it wasn't like a normal, you know, it wasn't like a Cliff Burton bass solo or Billy Sheehan. Because Billy Sheehan, it's like watching a guitar player with a bass.
For sure.
You know, but it was very musical, you know, watching
him play. Yeah, Stu's super musical. And that's actually why I really wanted him on the record. You know, why he was sort of like my first choice for it is that if
good
you've actually
choice.
Heard his album, I think just Outside of Normal. Is that the right? Am I saying it right? I think that's what it's called. His latest one.
Okay.
It's surprising, you know, like it really shows just how broad and diverse and how compositional he can be.
Wow. Very good. Now, I'm not familiar with the album. I'm going to have to go check
it out.
Now,
the one thing that I did notice and I wanted to ask you this is... your left hand is very, it's very pronounced. Like you can see, you can follow her.
It's very like exact and succinct.
Very exact. I mean, it really, and you know, and obviously you have small hands because you stretch a lot. Am I correct with that? I mean, in that video, it looks like you're really putting some stretch on there. And it's... I was just going to say it's a unique looking style. It doesn't really follow like what you would think would be that you see most guys do. I guess I just don't know if maybe it's because you have smaller hands
or we're from the classical training. Possibly
that's what I was thinking. Yeah. And the speed though is something that I'm like,
nice.
I was because it would look like to me it would look like it would be slower because it's so pronounced, right? And I was thinking, how is she pulling that off? Like, you know, that was the one thing I was like, because I always do that. You know, I always do the right hand thing. Like, if you watch Yngwie Malmsteen play, it doesn't look like his right hand is hardly even moving.
Right. It's very efficient.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's very efficient. Yeah. I mean, there's no spent energy whatsoever in his right hand. Meanwhile, the guy's flying all over the place. I don't know how he does it. But, you know, when I saw your left hand, I was like, how is she doing that? But it's got to be something that you've just learned, maybe the classical thing. I don't know.
It might be the class. It's so funny, you know, when it comes to actually making observations about oneself, it's like, I don't know.
You don't
know.
See it. Yeah.
Like, but I know that at least when it comes to reach, you know, and this is what happens because I think a lot of times, like, you know, I'm not a huge person. Like, I've got little wrists, I've got skinny fingers. And so a lot of times I'm sure most guy guitar players don't get this, but a lot of people want to examine my hands. And so it's made me kind of be like, yeah, why? What's going on? And so I've compared reaches with a lot of guitar players.
Huh. Yeah.
Oddly enough, my reach is bigger than I thought it would
wow.
be. And it's not because of anything physiological. I think it's specifically because of the classical training, which is that you learn to use all at your disposal. You know, so for me, unlike a huge number of rock players, like, I use my pinky all the time. I think I probably use my pinky 25% of the time. Like, wow. I've never shied away. Like, I don't really favor one finger. I mean, for certain things, like maybe I don't want to bend with my pinky or whatever. But I think some of it is that. Some of it's, I think, the thumb position on the back of the neck.
Yes.
Really comes from classical. And I think some of it is honestly just a physiological thing, which is like I have, I guess, skinny little girly fingers. but one of the things that is kind of funny about it is, you know, the flip side of it is recently there was a photo that was taken by Max Crace, who's a great photographer. He did a lot of Eric Johnson stuff and did the artwork for like Avia Musicom. He took a photo of me for a magazine called Pure Guitar. And, you know, a lot of times, like, I'm a guitar player. I am not a model. I do not particularly like being in front of a camera at all. It's like, dude, just take my picture and get it over with, you know? And I'm not comfortable, usually, unless I'm playing guitar, because then I can kind of forget about the camera. And so Max has learned through working with me that it's better if I'm playing. So he had me, you know, playing, and he snapped a shot, and I think I was just playing, like, I know exactly what chord I'm playing because of how many times I've been asked this. I'm playing an F major chord with a third on top. So it's like a D, like an open D form chord, but then like your first finger's on the root.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I don't know. It's like something I learned the first few weeks of playing guitar. But I like that voicing, having the third on top. It's basically a power chord with a third on top. Like, when I ended up posting the photo, I got so many questions where people were like, oh my God, what is that chord? You know, some less polite people insinuating that it was like a douchey, like, photo chord. And then in other places, like, I think, like, you know, a couple of the companies I endorse posted it. And that's where people are not your fans. They're people who are fans of the gear. And they're like, who is this chick? You know, and like a couple people convinced that it was a fake chord, which is so funny to me because I'm like, well, wait a minute. You actually think it's more likely that I would use a fake chord than you might not know the chord I'm playing. Wow. Okay.
Welcome to the land of guitar players.
Is there such a thing as a fake chord?
I mean, exactly. It's like really,
if it's okay, musical, how could it be fake?
And you know what? You want to talk about the douchey chord thing that you talked about? Look at any album or any picture of Chris Impellitteri, and you will see the douchiest pose that you've ever seen in your life.
The weirdest chord pose I've ever seen.
Major, an F major. There's not even an upper extension. Like, I couldn't.
You can't even defend yourself.
Exactly. I'm like, I can't even have this argument. But what it made me realize is that I guess my skinny little fingers make things look more intense than they are. But maybe it's for exactly the reason, which is that because they're skinny, you see the space between them more.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not stretching any more than any other dude is.
That's what I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you just see the empty space, and so it looks. It's why like ballerinas are skinny, you know.
Sure.
It looks like more movement when it's a skinny little thing going through there.
Well, here's something that you can take, and it may make you feel a little bit better. You knowing that chord, you probably have better than 90% of the guys that are out there, and definitely 100% of the guys that made the comments.
Well, for sure. It's not her, you know, with a fake chord. It's them not knowing what chord it is.
Yeah.
You know, come
but
on.
But it's such a funny thing. It's like, oh my God, let me please never be like that. Let me please never assume that my ignorance is somebody else's ignorance.
Right.
Well,
right.
I think a lot of it is too, is that, you know, when we, you know, as humans, especially people that just want to give that, you know, that 65%, where they feel comfortable, you know, where they do that C, let's go 70%, right? So they do that C average all the time, that when something gets shown to them, it's better to just dismiss it and lash out at it and just call it nothing, because that would mean that they would have to figure it out.
See, I think that's ridiculous, man, because if I I see something like that,
you want to know it.
I don't go, God, that's got to be fake. I go, what chord is that?
Yeah, how do I do that?
Right. Right. I will, you know, I'll finger it, figure out what's in there. And yeah. Go, oh.
That's why you own an amp company.
Right. Well, and that's why what's so funny about it to me. It's just like you said, like, I think between the classical background and the skinny little fingers, I feel like everything I play is so obvious. It's like, it isn't like watching like Yngwie or Steve Morse where like, you know, like they're doing something and their fingers are all close together and you're like, which finger's even down? It's like, there's no question about what I'm playing. And I'm like, dude, look at your guitar. Do you not know what, you know, that at that fifth fret on the E string, that that's an A, you know, and that right there at the six is an F, and then right there on the G, you know, it's like, okay.
But you want to see somebody that's hard to watch and like to even think of what they're playing? Joe Bonamassa. When you watch Joe Bonamassa go, you go, it doesn't even look like it should be coming out.
He's truly gotten so incredible over the last, 10 years.
He does a lot of two note per string, a lot of crazy.
I mean, and he'll be the first to tell you he plays in boxes.
Yes.
But those boxes sound freaking awesome.
Yeah, very Eric Johnson.
He's picked up a lot from Eric, yeah.
Yeah.
Eric's another one.
Yeah.
Eric's great. Well, he's actually one who I can tell what he's playing a lot more. But actually, you know what? I met Eric. He's a, you know, we're friends. Mm-hmm. He was the one who actually pointed out that our hands are surprisingly similar. I've got like shrunken. I've got girly version of his hands.
I'm sorry.
Which I wasn't gonna point that out, because it's kind of like being like, hey, Cindy Crawford, have you ever noticed we look a little bit alike? You know,
I know Eric as well. I've shaken his hand many times. And,
I get that with Brad Pitt.
Right, exactly. Like, Brad, did you notice? You know, our Brad, abs are kind
you know,
of
come on, man.
Similar.
That's right.
You know. It's getting a little tiring. You know.
Right.
People keep asking me to show my 8-pack. You know, it's, I'm a little tired of that, dude. Come on. So anyway, well, let's progress on to what gear those skinny little fingers are playing nowadays. Like, you know, do you have any favorite
skinny little
pedals?
Fingers are playing. Actually, not the wussiest strings out there. I play GHS strings, 10 through 52s, top, heavy, bottom.
Oh yeah.
Which I like. I have 11s on some of my guitars, and on the Les Pauls they work well with a slightly shorter scale length. Mm-hmm. But like, especially for my main guitar, which is a Music Man Silhouette Special, that one actually has the tremolo. The heavier strings, when you go to bend them, especially with the movement that you get from the tremolo, 10 through 52s are the ones that I keep gravitating towards. So yeah, my main guitar is a Music Man Silhouette. I also have a Sadowski nylon string electric that is cool and unlike anything else, which I love. It's like, I've actually been playing some gypsy jazz on it, you know, very badly, but with great joy. My latest acquisition is a Steven Strom acoustic guitar. It's called an Eros model, and he's just this amazing luthier. And I've never actually had... I've always subscribed to at least what I thought was common knowledge, which is that in order for an acoustic guitar to play well, it has to sound like crap and vice versa. Like, the better it feels, the worse it sounds. This one totally blows that whole notion out of the water. Like, I mean,
nice.
I can, you know, I play classical guitar. I play electric guitar. Steel string is a totally different deal and is also pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've been playing this one, and it's like I can play for 3 solid hours and it feels great. I mean, it's I can't say enough good about it.
Wow.
So there's that. But I have Music Man Majesty. I have, like, Music Man's definitely the largest category in my stable, in terms of guitars. Obviously, I have the Les Paul and the Dan Electro for Zeppelin.
Cool. Oh, you have a Dano too. Right,
yeah, I have a Dan Electro.
Yeah.
The best shitty guitar out there.
Totally.
It sounds so perfect.
The best shitty guitar. That ought to be their new logo on their site. Dan Electro, the best shitty guitar out there.
I actually don't mean. I mean it as much as it sounded wrong. I mean it in a good way. It's like, you know, it would be totally wrong to play When the Levee Breaks on like a really expensive Paul Reed Smith. It's like no. Like,
right.
Like
sacrilegious.
You know, yeah, the guitar's got so much mojo in just the right way, and I love it actually.
That's great.
That's cool.
So those are my main guitars. I mean, I got a few others too. But those are the main ones. And then the main amp that I've been using is the Turok Bionics, but I also have, you know, the Marshall, the Fender, the Engel.
You still have your Deluxe?
I do. I still have my Deluxe. I will never get rid of it.
That nice. Is so cool.
That, yeah.
We've talked to a couple people, you know, that have the very first guitar, the very first amp, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. and it's cool to hear that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, for sure.
Because God knows where that stuff that I bought.
I don't have the first. You know, I do have the second, which needs a few parts to put back together. Yeah. I do have the second one, but I don't have the third one. The third one was actually a Unibox copy of a Les Paul.
Oh, well, there you go.
Black.
Of course.
Pedals. Into any pedals? Besides the tuner, of course.
Of course. The tuner, my favorite.
makes us all sound better.
Oh, my God. Talk about the most important pedal out there.
So many people don't use that one.
Exactly.
Especially in gear demos. Dear God.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Please tune the guitar first. Thank you.
I'll
shut up now.
What I've also noticed is that, you know, and it makes sense, is that tuning is, there is a subjective element of tuning, simply because we are inherently out of tune with our Western tempered system. You know, mm-hmm. all major thirds are a little bit sharp, you know, so... It's interesting how much, you know, you can sit there and put something in tune and have perfectly intonated instrument, and yet if your ears aren't in tune, you're naturally kind of not bending things where they should be, or yeah. anyway, mm-hmm. that's a whole different deal. But pedals. I work with the companies that I use and that I work with are Dunlop and Providence. I've got other things here and there from a few other places like Maxon and Radial. But Providence, I love. I've been using their Chrono Delay, which is the coolest pedal. It's slightly bigger than like a regular, you know, kind of MXR size pedal. Mm-hmm. But it isn't as big as, say, like that Line 6 one that yeah. is just a monster.
Right.
Adds 13 pounds
like,
to the
Yeah, I did like that pedal, but I went through two of them. Their power freaked out on me twice. So, mm-hmm.
yes.
But the Chrono Delay I love. I have that on both of my pedal boards. They make a beautiful chorus too, the Pure Anodyne Chorus.
Oh.
And a lot of great boost pedals. I love the Exotic Effects AC booster.
Mm-hmm.
I have a vintage Dunlop Crybaby. Actually, a new one too they sent me that I'm excited to try out. I just got an Eddie Van Halen flanger from Dunlop.
Mm.
And yeah. Cool. But cool. Both got Providence, Dunlop, I mean, everything is great. It's just like pick your flavor. Pick yeah. the flavor that works with the combination and for the purposes that you're using.
Totally.
So yes. I swap stuff out a little bit, but.
Huh. That's, yeah, I mean, Dunlop, the stable of pedals they are making nowadays. I mean, I think they're making the Way Huge stuff now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yep. there's just so much under that roof.
The
now.
Swollen pickle.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
yeah, that went away for a while, but it came back.
Exactly. I like the variation that you can get now through all these pedal manufacturers is mm-hmm. amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. if you remember back in the day, you pretty much had MXR, Vox had the Wah, and Electro Harmonix, mm-hmm. and not much more outside
right,
of
right.
that. There were some other things, but I'm talking in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
you know. But now, I mean, you got guys in their garages building some very cool stuff.
Absolutely.
And, you know, to have that really makes it competitive, and you can pretty much dial in whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the day, it was Distortion Plus. And that was it.
Right.
You know, yeah. And then you had the electro harmonics, the Big Muff. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Small Stone and stuff like that for the, you know, but outside of that, there wasn't a whole lot. And they were.
And a wah. You know?
Yeah. And it wasn't really obtainable.
Face. Yeah.
You know,
right.
It was, you had to find music stores that sold pedals. Because
yeah,
the one right. I grew up near, it didn't have any for a long time.
Well, if you needed the pedal, you weren't a real guitar player.
Exactly.
That's right. You're going to need that crutch. Learn how to play the guitar, son. But yeah, there's so much out there now. So
now, I wanted to say
she keeps her rig pretty basic.
Yeah, and I wanted to say one thing about the tuner thing. Have you ever played any fretless guitars?
No, I have not. I mean,
Vizier.
The closest I come to that is playing slide, which renders it fretless, you know,
okay,
momentarily.
Yeah.
But I know Vizier.
Yeah, they make one.
I'm totally curious about it, but also kind of like terrified of it. Like,
yeah.
I just know how, like, because my sister has a violin,
oh, yeah,
and I picked it up a couple of times, and boy, is it sobering. Like, you know, not to have those frets.
That's a great word.
Yeah, well, you know what? Here's something for you to research. Guthrie Govan does a demo
for
the
Vizier.
And what I love is I'd say about 20 seconds into the video, after he's playing this incredible opening, he states, yeah, I've been, I've been playing on this now for about 45 minutes.
Oh my God.
And I realize that you can't bend strings. You can't bend them. You have to you have to go up and down to get that vibrato, you know, and they use like 12s on them or something. It's a little bit different. It's like the fingerboard is actually metallic, you know, on
really?
That guitar. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. On that version, they make a new version now. It's not metallic, I guess, because it has to take so much more abuse from those heavy strings.
Yeah,
the actual fretboard.
Interesting.
But I knew a guy that was a violin repair guy, and he told me one day, he said, the guitar is horrible. He said the math is completely wrong. That's why it never stays in tune throughout the whole thing.
And yeah, it's never perfectly intonated.
And then they have those compensated necks with that. You've seen those frets that kind of look like zigzags.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the fan frets.
Yeah, or the temper.
The ones up at the nut, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, the whole fingerboard.
The entire fingerboard. Every
Steve Vai has one.
Every string.
Yeah.
Almost every string on almost every position has the fret in a slightly different position.
Yeah, they call it true temper.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
okay.
Crazy.
Yeah, and you can't really bend too much, because when you bend, the next string could be, you know, literally a half inch
different.
Yeah.
Those necks are very expensive. I heard they're like $1,200.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Because they have to put little pieces of the fret in there. It's
not
one bar.
It's every string's got its little own piece of fret.
It's a company out of Germany. And they can make those tempers for different tunings. I'm like,
really?
Yeah, I don't have to worry about buying that.
Me neither. I'm happily playing out of tune for the rest of my life.
For years I've been doing it.
There you go. Oh, man, well, that's crazy. Yeah, if you haven't...
Wow.
So we left you with something, a weird neck that you've never seen before, and you've left us with a plethora of information.
I'm blown away.
Yeah, right.
By your background, man. That is just amazing.
It's great. Yeah, so...
Thank you.
And what makes me a little sick is when she started, though.
I know.
It's like, oh, my God.
You know, if we all started then, I'd be on my second guitar, and I'd probably know 5 chords by now.
And me, too. I would have given it up.
Right.
I'd have sold it on eBay.
Totally.
Well, you know what? Actually, I have to say, I don't know what would have happened had I not had the classical teacher I had, because I just assumed I was starting too late, and... I can't overstate how important it is to have had somebody who, from my first lesson, when I kind of, you know, I guess I sort of underplayed what I thought was possible. And from day one, he taught me like I would be a professional. And from day one, he told me that I wasn't starting too late. He had actually started, I think, around, you know, in his late teens also. And Frank Zappa started when he was 19. So kind of having that knowledge was like, okay, all right. You know, let's just see what's possible.
I don't think it's a downfall. I think, you know, you're still developing well, especially for a male. You're still developing all the way, you know, 24, 25.
Oh, for sure.
And as long as you can put the hours in, See, the reason that so many people, you know, if you try to start when you're 30, you're not going to do much because you have a career or you're living in a box.
Right.
But when you're 19, you're probably not doing a whole lot. You're not, you know, you're in college or you just got out of high school and you're working at the local whatever. So you can put the hours in.
Yeah. There's that. But, you know, also to have an instructor who
believes in you,
instills such confidence
sure.
in you. You know, that really says a lot. Finding the right instructor, I think, is it's really important. And people that find them are really lucky.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
All right.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much for being live. Are you playing out live anywhere with
Zeparella
or solo or?
Yeah. Right now, Zeparella has been really busy. We play live a lot, pretty regularly.
I see the Instagram posts.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Cool. Cool.
Yeah. We have a couple weekends off, which actually I asked for because I'm working on my next album, and that's one of those things that it's really easy to have life get in the way of, furthering yourself, you know, like as an artist, you know, being creative, all of that. So they were nice enough to kind of chill out on booking for a little bit so I could, you know, this album I've been working on actually for a couple of years now.
Nice.
Try to make a little bit more headway and hoping to have it done by the end of the year.
Cool.
But in the meantime, yeah, Zeparella is playing all over. I think we just played on the East Coast. Before that, we were in Dallas playing a festival. Coming up, I think we're doing some shows in the Northwest. And then actually we're heading back to Texas in late July. I think Houston, Austin, Dallas, I think.
Well, very cool.
That is very cool.
We'll let our listeners know about that. And, you know, we'll put that link and
all the stuff.
Her site on there as well.
Yep. It'll be up there with the show. Stay there forever.
Very cool.
Till the internet crashes.
We call that perpetuity.
Yes. Until the sunspot takes all the internet out. And
until nothing but tubes work.
Exactly. Right. Jeff's our purist.
There you go.
He keeps it real.
That's right. That's right. Well, Gretchen, thank you again for taking the time to be on with us and giving us the whole story of Gretchen Men and you know what got you into this crazy world. So, thank you.
Oh well, it's so much fun to talk about. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure, man. Our pleasure. And have a great rest of the evening and much continued success to you.
Thank you so much. You guys have a wonderful evening too.
Thanks. Right. Take care.
Okay. Thanks.
Right, bye. Well, and there you have the story.
And what a story.
Two stories in one.
It was just awesome.
It was great.
You know?
Yeah. It's, you know, so what? You start a little bit late.
Yeah.
You know? It's...
And let me tell you, I want everybody to know this. We went for another 15 minutes after we said goodbye.
That
she
is true.
She
that
is without true. A doubt just the greatest because she just, you know, her dime and... you know, to talk to us. I mean, it was her time.
Oh, for sure.
And she just kept talking. And you know, we got some IDs like we always do and everything. But just you can tell just a good soul.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And, you know, very into what she does. And
and very smart.
Yes. Yes.
I would probably feel a little intimidated if I had to.
Yes. Very.
I'm not exactly the
intellectual. Well, you know,
I've worked on a construction site. Never flew a plane. Definitely didn't have any classical music instruction, and both of my parents were not in the arts.
Mm-hmm. So almost the same life.
Just
completely different.
Just the parallel opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
Utopia compared to this side of hell. No, I'm just kidding.
But you know, it's really interesting how someone that is, you know, officially and trained in music, you know, like classical or jazz or whatever it is, how they, once they get involved in it, approach the rock or pop end of things, you know, because it's all music.
Yeah.
But it is different. And, you know, I think having more than one style influence, and especially formal schooling in other influences, really it makes you a different kind of player and you learn things differently. And I'm surprised. I was pleasantly surprised when, you know, she turned out to be not jaded when it came to dissecting other music, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It was so refreshing to hear that.
Absolutely.
You know,
I would love to have somebody in a band that had her knowledge.
Oh, no,
so I could,
sure,
like, you know, bounce ideas off and go, am I upside down on this or what?
Mm-hmm.
Just to get that side of it.
Oh, no, absolutely.
You know, and that to me would be, I would be like a little kid in a candy store, man.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'd be like, hey, look, I put this, but what do you think? And it would be like, I don't even know what you're doing, or that's pretty cool, you know?
Right.
You know? And then maybe get the explanation.
But exactly, they would know why it's cool.
Yeah, and that would be cool because then they could tell you.
Right, and
be
then
like
you would
guitar
know.
Lessons for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Only deeper than guitar lessons, you know. It's more in compositional, which really interests me.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's very well rounded, very well educated, very well spoken, and just a fun guest.
Absolutely.
And a pilot.
Yeah. That's the craziest thing ever. I didn't even know that part.
I did a little research.
See, you did a little bit there.
A little research.
I knew about Stu Ham.
Well, so, there you go. So you got that one on me.
I just kind of go the other way. But anyway.
That's okay. You went the music way.
Yes. So, my friend, until next time.
Damn right there is.
I'm Mick Marcellino.
That's right.
And you are?
I'm still showing up next week as Jeff Bober.
And we are always saying.
Onward.
Be sure and follow the show on Twitter, at AmpsAndAxes. Also, make sure you like the show on Facebook. For news, comments, and everything else, visit the webpage, AmpsAndAxesCast.com. Thanks for listening.